Wally, good news, bad news here. You have a traumatic engine failure, but with the altitude that you have, you've got some precious time. How do you best use that time to achieve a positive outcome? Some real challenges here, but some opportunity to make some good choices.
Well, absolutely, Bob. I think certainly a dead stick landing from 20,000 feet is a challenging maneuver for anybody. The altitude is the resource you have right now, and that's going away quickly. So you don't have a lot of time to do all this math that we talked about. You don't have a lot of time to think this through. Hopefully you've spent some of your time in cruise playing what if, thinking how would I handle such a situation. Hopefully you're maintaining situational awareness, so at least you have some idea of which airports are available to you. But it's a real challenge for sure, and it requires a lot of thought, and in this case, to make the airport I selected, some pretty quick decision making.
I'm very impressed with your initial analysis when you had the engine failure. I'm not so sure that I would be quite as equipped to really, you know, to calculate, you know, option A, option B, option C, quite as analytically. And so there's going to be some wasted time there in the panic mode and what do I do? And boy, I'll tell you what, the last thing you want to do is start one way and then go back another way. So you really need to take enough time to make your first decision a good one, but not, you know, be paralyzed by indecision. And I think it's really be very easy to be paralyzed by indecision here, I believe.
Oh, I agree. It's a shocking thing to be cruising along and have that engine quit dead for no apparent reason. That's going to be a big surprise, and you need to recognize that could happen to you. And again, you know, playing what if, at least you've done some of the mental processes before it happens, and hopefully it never happens to any of us.
Well, and let's talk a little bit about these options. I think, you know, you decided, you know, your location, you know, was going to be Kimball. Is that the best option? Anybody else going to go anyplace else? Jeff?
I think it's a totally viable option, and when I sit there and look at the analysis, it makes a lot of sense. I'll be perfectly honest that if I was sitting in that bonanza, the very first thing I would do once I have already turned direct Cheyenne is put the nose down for 20 knots just right off the bat and look at the GPS and see whether that changed, whether I was going to make it or not. I'm already headed in that direction. I know from experience that 20 knots on most GA airplanes does very little to the affect the best glide. Yes, best glide is at a given speed. That's why we call it best. And anything faster than that doesn't glide as far, no wind. But the increase of descent rate up to those 20, even 25 knots on most planes is really minimal, and it can make a huge difference in how far you go into the wind.
I bet that a lot of folks are going to think about Pine Bluff, because that's the closest airport.
I am.
Okay.
I am. I'd go for the sure thing. I don't know that I'd be in the frame of mind to compute the distances and make the analysis at of the descent rate to project to another airport. I've got a sure thing below me, I would think, Pine Bluff's 1,000-foot ceiling. I'd use that GPS to spiral down in that area and try to set up an approach to that runway. Sure, it's not the longest runway available, but a bonanza of 5,300 feet, even at a 5,100-foot elevation, I think that would be doable or a more guaranteed arrival than trying to do some computations to go to Cheyenne or to Kimball. That just doesn't seem like I could feel comfortable with that.
Yeah, a 1,000-foot ceiling is a major issue, but that's a lot different than maybe a 600-foot ceiling. So you would have some time to maneuver over the airport. One of the decision points against landing there was the lack of facilities. So on your way down, one of the things you could do is to tell the controllers to notify the local first responders to send people out there. I've actually been on on an airport when all of a sudden the fire trucks and an ambulance showed up, and that was the first indication we had that an emergency airplane was inbound. So that is an option as well that most pilots probably don't think about.
Well, that would be pretty much standard. You're going to tell the controller that you have an engine failure and you're gliding, and they're going to wherever you go, that's pretty much SOP. They're going to call the local fire and whatever emergency services. But one of the things that you have to be very careful with ATC here also is generally a controller is going to be very spring-loaded to the nearest airport. We even have software in all the radar displays. It's a nearest airport patch. It's just like the GPS nearest airport patch. You hit that, and it's going to give a vector or heading that the pilot can fly to it. It's also going to be very difficult for the controller to accept you going somewhere, mentally anyhow, the way we think, going somewhere else that's further away. They're going to try and do that. And I've seen situations where a pilot had a pretty good plan. They wanted to land on a beach, had an engine failure. Controller insisted that he turn towards an airport, didn't make the airport, and with less than good results.
Actually, a question for you, John, on that. The nearest airport that they'd recommend, would Pine Bluff come up? Or
yes.
Because it doesn't have an instrument approach and your IMC
elsewhere? There's actually – well, it depends upon which system you're using. But in the terminal system, if you hit the nearest airport key, it'll hit nearest without any filters. And then you can filter it for hard surface over 3,000 feet, hard surface over 5,000. It's just by hitting nearest plus one, plus two, plus three – with an instrument approach. So the short answer to that is Pine Bluff would be the nearest.
But you could ask ATC specifically, I need the nearest hard surface, I need the nearest, and they have a quick filter to just do that as well.
Yes.
That's cool. I never knew that, actually.
Yeah.
And I have a question also. Would the controller be inclined to send them directly to the airport?
Yes.
Or would they be inclined to send them, vector them for an approach to that airport?
Probably point them right at the airport.
Okay.
And that's not always the best thing either. And then just to follow up on that a little bit too, ATC can also be a distraction at this point. They're going to start asking a million questions. The soul's on board, fuel, what's your intent? You may need to just tell them, look, shut up for a minute. I got an airplane to deal with here. I'll get back to you when I can. And I'm going to make the decision on which way we're going to go here. And here's what I need from you as opposed to – and then they're going to say, how you doing, and pointing out the airport and stuff. So,
well, I want to come back to your first action. Okay, you're the pilot in command. Is your first action trying to get the engine going again or get pointed toward a safe landing option? Help me out here. Tom, what are you going to do?
This is what I teach. And in the program that I manage, this is what we teach. It happens to be for Bonanza pilots. First action, maintain control of the aircraft. We're aiming for our best glide speed. We're establishing a pitch attitude and configuration for that. Second action I teach them is aim somewhere. Point the airplane someplace. And as Wally was saying, you need to be playing this game all the time. Where am I going to go if it quits right now? We do that when we first learn to fly. We tend to forget to do that later on in our flying careers. But only after you've done number one, maintain control of the aircraft, number two, aim somewhere, number three, do we say, as altitude permits, attempt to restart. So that's the way I prioritize it.
Because you really do have enough time. If the engine is going to restart, okay, you have 14,000 feet in this case okay, the engine starts, that's great, but getting going towards a viable landing option is and as you said, boy, number one, maintain aircraft control. If you don't do that, the rest of this is all academic.
But I think a lot of people's first action is the push to talk button. They want to talk to somebody about this.
You're going to get 20 questions, and souls on board, fuel on board, which is pretty academic at this point because
it's not running.
But well, they need to know how much foam to spray on a.
The next part of what Tom mentioned, I think, is important also, and that is that we need to all develop a flow pattern in that cockpit for whatever airplane we're flying of the common engine failure issues, fuel selector, mixture, mags, fuel pumps, whatever it is for your airplane. You need to have a flow pattern, not waiting to pick up a checklist and giving up 5,000 feet of that precious altitude while you're going through it to get the common things that may very well get you going.
Really, there are three elements that an engine needs in order to develop power. It needs fuel, it needs ignition, it needs a source of induction air. Historically, in a fuel-injected engine, it's going to be a fuel-related issue. If it's something that you can fix from where you sit in the pilot seat, it's going to be by manipulating the fuel control. So that's where you get into fuel selectors, mixture control, auxiliary boost pumps, that sort of thing. Induction air, some airplanes have alternate systems, some have automatic systems. in a carbureted engine, that's the most likely issue, a carburetor icing. So that becomes the first thing you do. And then, of course, dealing with ignition issues. So no matter what type of airplane you're in, if you look at the engine failure restart procedure, it's going to be some variation of adjust the fuel things, adjust the air things, adjust the ignition things. And if you just remember fuel, ignition, air, or in a carbureted engine, air, fuel, ignition, that will remind you of what you need to do.
You know, building on that point, take it a little further is really understanding the systems in your specific airplane, because we're talking about a turbocharged piston engine at 22,000 feet. Well, now we're so used to fuel. If fuel is the issue, there's not enough. In this case, there may be way too much, because what we've lost is the pressurization, and going way lean may actually bring back power, and turning on a boost pump would be the worst thing you could do. So this is a kind of understanding that you need to have. And I know, I'm sure there are people at this table who've had these experiences in turbocharged airplanes.
Jeff, I had an experience many years ago in a Cessna 421 at altitude where a turbocharger mechanically failed internally. And it appeared to be a complete engine failure, which it was at altitude. But power started coming back below 10,000 feet, miraculously. And it really was an issue of mixture and atmospheric pressure. That engine just wasn't going to run up at altitude with a very rich mixture. It was, for all practical purposes, putting out no power. So that's another alternative that needs to be kept in mind. You might have a surprise as you get down to lower altitude.
That would be a pleasant surprise.
That would be a pleasant surprise, yes.
And two things about that. First, and this is getting very type specific, but I'm sure it's reflected in other aircraft types as well. For instance, in the turbocharged Bonanza, the checklist tells you don't even attempt a restart above 18,000 feet. You have to glide down until you have enough air naturally to try to get it restarted. Secondly, there are any number of bad things that can be going on with a loss of turbocharging power. So a trap would be that you descend down to 10,000, 12,000 feet and you have some power available and you think, okay, now I can turn around and go to Cheyenne or something. You still need to get the airplane on the ground because it could get very bad.
I agree with that.
Something else to consider in this, especially in a long glide like this, where we're talking 10 or 15, maybe even potentially 20 minutes worth of gliding time, is you're probably going to lose your gyros because you have no vacuum, depending upon what kind of system. And you may even run out of battery. You know, batteries are good for 30 minutes. You get down to that pattern and you're still running this airplane that we're using here with dual Garmins, it's got an Aspen PFD, you got de-icing, you got oxygen, you know, all this stuff on board. You may get down to the pattern and find you have nothing left.
And your GPS relying on that moving map for that final turn to landing.
But who would even
another
think of
good
that?
Reason to go to Pine Bluffs?
Well, see, and that's, I think we need to focus on that. I mean, what's the difference in comfort level for Kimball versus Pine Bluff? I mean, Wally, I can appreciate, you know, the peace of mind it gives you heading for a place that gives you a structured way to get in there versus getting on top and feeling comfortable. Okay, I am going to break out. Well, that's a leap of faith. I mean, you're betting that the ceiling is what you're expecting. And if it is 600, well, moving from 600 feet, wow, that's going to be a challenge for any pilot. So there's a different comfort level there. How do we feel about, you know, the trade-offs on that?
Well, we've had more time to analyze this at this roundtable than our poor pilot did. So, you know, it's pretty easy to get into the little things. But for me, the unattended part of that airport is just uncomfortable. If I can get to an attended airport that happens to give me a bonus extra 1,000 feet on the runway, that's two things that would make me pursue that option. I think that, as Jeff said earlier, probably the most natural thing to do is to just keep going to Cheyenne because that's out there in front. And maybe that's part of this scenario that we also need to remember that the best airport may not be closest and it may be behind us.
What about practicing? Because I want to put that on the table here. We've got several things that have come up that are not normally practiced and are in fact poorly understood. One is the concept of if you're going into a headwind and you're not going to make it, that increasing your speed, forward speed, even with the greater descent rate, you may make it. I love practicing that. Well, we get a nice gusty day blowing down the runway, and we'll do glides towards a runway, power idle glides, not power off glides, and get to a position, all right, we're not going to make the runway here at Best Glide. Put the nose down, and you can really see it. And it's like a visceral experience that locks it in your mind. My gosh, I mean, we're going to be right on brick one, but we're actually going to make it at a higher speed. Same thing about that circling down your 1,500 feet. You know, that doing that for the first time when all the eggs are in the basket, that's not what I want to be doing it. So how do we practice these things? How do you prepare
for that?
Obviously,
you practice with an instructor or a safety pilot. Because, you talked about doing this, using the OBS to set out extended center lines. I've done that a lot of times with students, and invariably it turns out bad. Mm-hmm. It's very, very difficult. You can start 3,000 or 4,000 feet over the airport, put them under the hood, put the center lines out, and try to manage a pattern when your visual references are just, you're looking at the 430 with the 2 mile scale there. You know, how far am I from the runway? And
well, this pilot has two options. He can go either way on the runway.
Yeah.
I mean,
managing that takes practice. And yes. The first time you do this, you got to be 100% right. And the only way you can do that is it's with some practice. Mm-hmm. I tried this just as an experiment in the simulator when we were researching this, and I actually made Kimball. And I made Kimball with 2,000 feet to spare. But I had no idea what to do when I got to the airport. I arrived over the top of the airport with 2,000 feet to spare. And now you're like, should I try and go out for the approach? Should I try and make like an abbreviated approach? Should I go around once? Remember, you still got a pretty good wind that you're not going to have any way of really judging looking at that little display in the Garmin. It was a lot more challenging than you think.
I, as a result of this scenario, went out and practiced a bit myself. I think that's the key. Bob, I've heard Bob mention so many times in safety meetings, how long has it been since you've tried an emergency landing? And the answer is, if you haven't done it in the last couple of weeks, you're probably going to mess it up.
Yeah.
I went out with my airplane and Garmin 430, and I found if I just kept the runway just on the very edge of the screen, that made a pretty nice downwind for me.
How many times around did it take you to get that?
Oh, well, I did it a number of times. And,
right, this guy's got once.
Oh, yeah, I understand. But isn't that the point of talking about this, that we need to practice?
There's a great reluctance, and in this class of airplane especially, there's a great reluctance to practice engine failure procedures because of concerns about health of the engine itself during the practice. There are some ways around that. For instance, I found that if you carry a bottom of the green arc manifold pressure approach flaps and gear down in a Bonanza, since we're talking about a Bonanza, you will get about exactly the same pitch attitudes and descent rates at best glide speed that you would get if you pull the power back and pull the prop back in a clean configuration. So you can, if you fly with an instructor who's familiar with the type, or if you do a little experimentation on your own on a good smooth day, clear day, you can learn how to approximate the glide performance of your airplane, and then you can go out there and practice spiral down maneuvers and that sort of thing. Most pilots, in my experience, flying in 210s and Moonies and Bonanzas and this sort of thing, are never going to practice that because they're scared to death of what it's going to do to the engine.
You know, and seriously, just quickly hitting the practice issue again, one thing about engine out approaches, everyone is different. Everyone is different. I don't care if you practiced one yesterday, the variables today are different. So that's why, the comfort level and the confidence level are very, very important. So, point number one, gosh, practice engine failures. The other is, remember, your priorities change when you have an engine failure. It's not about saving the airplane. It's about living through it. And you really have to make that mindset change. You know, we're used to landing on runways. We land on runways all the time, so we want to land on a runway. Our airplane is properly configured when we land, so we want the gear preferably down. But these things are not our priority on this, and we need to remember those variables as we approach this. The terrain out there is very, very flat. We have that going for us. Once we get below the clouds, we need to maintain control. That's where you're going to die, loss of control. So maintaining control, throughout this approach is very, very important.
And let the insurance company worry about the airplane.
Right. Absolutely. The insurance company already owns the airplane. You're just delivering it to the scene of the claim.
You know, we talked about the ATC being a potential distraction. What about the passenger sitting next to us? Yeah. How are they going to respond? How do we manage that? Can we use that person effectively? Have we thought about that? Part of the pre-takeoff briefing, you know, we'll start that. And if we've done that, you know, this person is ready to help us, and they know how they can, their participation will help or hurt us.
And a briefing for if you do make an off-airport landing, you know, unlatch the door, headset off, slide the seat back, tighten up the seat belts, all that stuff that we don't typically think of that either when we're doing. You just think we're going to do this practice approach to a dead stick landing someplace, but there's some preparation.
Picking up on something John said, something we don't think about in a briefing for an off-airport landing is getting out of the airplane and meeting up. That's the other one that I would add, especially if it's dark or if it's there's a lot of terrain, to say, like, when we get out, everybody go to the back of the airplane. We'll meet by the tail. If we can't meet by the tail, we'll meet, you know, off to the pilot side, because it may be chaos getting out of the airplane. You may have one person on one side and one person on another. You know, the one time I was in a situation like that, we both went in completely opposite directions away from the plane, which was fine. But then we had to kind of meet back up somewhere and see our airplane.
One more issue here we haven't touched on, and that's personal minimums. You really need to decide whether you want to fly across country with 1,000-foot ceilings in a single-engine airplane. That is an issue that you need to come to grips with.
So I think what we come down to here are our priorities. You know, when this event occurs and it happens just like that, we really need to be in a position to establish our priorities, maintain aircraft control, get pointed someplace, and use the resources that we have available to us. In this case, altitude. Use it wisely. You can't get it back. We have several good options. Pick a good option and one that will allow you a high probability of success. And then once again, prioritize all the way down. If you can get the airplane going again, that's a good thing, but it is not your highest priority. Maintain aircraft control, get a landing spot, get safely on the ground, start looking for help that can help you when I get on the ground. ATC can help you with that. You do have resources available to you. You just need to prioritize how you're going to use them effectively to get you and your passengers safely on the ground.